Side 12.
That's Vega? That's what all the fuss is about? The president asked with some disappointment. The photo opportunity for the press was now over, and her eyes had become almost dark-adapted after the onslaught of flashbulbs and television lighting. The pictures of the president gazing steely-eyed through the Naval Observatory telescope that appeared in all the papers the next day were, of course, a minor sham. She had been unable to see anything at all through the telescope until the photographers had left and darkness returned.
Why does it wiggle?
It's turbulence in the air, Miss President, Jahir explained. Warm bubbles of air go by and distort the image. Like looking at Sai across the breakfast table when there's a toaster between us. I can remember seeing one whole side of his face fall off, she said affectionately, raising her voice so the presidential consort, standing nearby, talking to the uniformed commandant of the observatory, could overhear.
Yeah, no toaster on the breakfast table these days, he replied amiably.
Seymour Lasker was, before his retirement, a high official of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. He had met his wife decades before, when she was representing the New York Girl Coat Company, and they had fallen in love over a protracted labor settlement. Considering the present novelty of both their positions, the apparent health of their relationship was noteworthy. I can do without the toaster, but I'm not getting enough breakfasts with Sai. She inflected her eyebrows in his general direction, and then returned to the monocular eyepiece. It looks like a blue amoeba, all squishy. After the difficult crew selection meeting, the president was in a light-hearted frame of mind. Her cold was almost gone. What if there was no turbulence, Ken? What would I see then? Then it would be just like space telescope above the Earth's atmosphere. You'd see a steady, unflickering point of light. Just the star? Just Vega? No planets, no rings, no laser battle stations?
No, Miss President, all that would be much too small and faint to see, even with a very big telescope.
Well, I hope your scientists know what they're doing, she said in a near whisper. We're making an awful lot of commitments on something we've never seen. Jahir was a little taken aback.
But we've seen 31,000 pages of text, pictures, words, plus a huge primer. In my book, that's not the same as seeing it.
It's a little too inferential.
Don't tell me about scientists all over the world getting the same data. I know all that. And don't tell me about how clear and unambiguous the blueprints for the machine are. I know that, too. And if we back out, someone else is sure to build the machine.
I know all those things. But I'm still nervous. The party ambled back through the Naval Observatory compound to the Vice President's residence. Tentative agreements on crew selection had been painstakingly worked out in Paris in the last weeks. The United States and the Soviet Union had argued for 2 crew positions each. On such matters, they were reliable allies. But it was hard to sustain this argument with the other nations in the World Message Consortium. These days, it was much more difficult for the United States and the Soviet Union, even on issues on which they agreed, to work their way with the other nations of the world than had once been the case. The Enterprise was now widely touted as an activity of the human species. The name World Message Consortium was about to be changed to World Machine Consortium. Nations with pieces of the message tried to use this fact as an entree for one of their nationals as a member of the crew. The Chinese had quietly argued that by the middle of the next century, there would be 1.5 billion of them in the world, but with many born as only children because of the Chinese experiment on state-supported birth control. Those children, once grown, would be brighter, they predicted, and more emotionally secure than children of other nations with less stringent rules on family size. Since the Chinese would thus be playing a more prominent role in world affairs in another 50 years, they argued, they deserved at least 1 of the 5 seats on the machine. It was an argument now being discussed in many nations by officials with no responsibility for the message or the machine. Europe and Japan surrendered crew representation in exchange for major responsibility for the construction of machine components, which they believed
would be of major economic benefit. In the end, a seat was reserved for the United States, the Soviet Union, China, and India, with the fifth seat undecided. This represented a long and difficult multilateral negotiation, with population size, economic, industrial, and military power, present political alignments, and even a little of the history of the human species as considerations. For the fifth seat, Brazil and Indonesia made representations based on population size and geographical balance. Sweden proposed a moderating role in case of political disputes. Egypt, Iraq, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia argued on grounds of religious equity. Others suggested that at least this fifth seat should be decided on grounds of individual merit rather than national affiliation. For the moment, the decision was left in limbo, a wild card for later. In the four selected nations, scientists, national leaders, and others were going through the exercise of choosing their candidates. A kind of national debate ensued in the United States. In surveys and opinion polls, religious leaders, sports heroes, astronauts, Congressional Medal of Honor winners, scientists, movie actors, a former presidential spouse, television talk show hosts and news anchors, members of Congress, millionaires with political ambitions, foundation executives, singers of country and western and rock and roll music, university presidents, and the current Miss America were all endorsed with varying degrees of enthusiasm. By long tradition, ever since the vice president's residence was moved to the grounds of the Naval Observatory, the house servants had been Filipino petty officers on active duty in the U.S. Navy. Wearing smart blue blazers with a patch embroidered Vice President of the United States, they were now serving coffee. Most of the participants in the all-day crew selection meeting had not been invited to this informal evening session. It had been Seymour Lasker's singular fate to be America's first gentleman. He bore his burden, the editorial cartoons, the smarmy jokes, the witticism that he had gone where no man had gone before, with such directness and good nature that at last America was able to forgive him for marrying a woman with the nerve to imagine that she could lead half the world. Lasker had the vice president's wife and teenage son laughing uproariously as the president guided Terhier into an adjacent library annex. "All right," she began. "There's no official decision to be made today, and no public announcement of our deliberations. But let's see if we can sum up. We don't know what the goddamn machine will do, but it's a reasonable guess that it goes to Vega. Nobody has the slightest idea of how it would work or even how long it would take. Tell me again, how far away is Vega?"
26 light years, Miss President.
"And so if this machine were a kind of spaceship and could travel as fast as light, I know it can't travel as fast as light, only close to it, don't interrupt, then it would take 26 years for it to get there. But only as we measure time here on Earth. Is that right, Terhier?"
Yes, exactly. Plus maybe a year to get up to light speed and a year to decelerate into the Vega system. But from the standpoint of the crew members, it would take a lot less. Maybe only a couple of years, depending on how close to light speed they travel."
"For a biologist, Terhier, you've been learning a lot of astronomy."
"Thank you, Miss President. I've tried to immerse myself in the subject."
She stared at him for just a moment and then went on.
"So, as long as the machine goes very close to the speed of light, it might not matter much how old the crew members are. But if it takes 10 or 20 years or more, and you say that's possible, then we ought to have somebody young. Now, the Russians aren't buying this argument. We understand it's between Arkhangelsky and Lunacharsky, both in their 60s.
She had read the name somewhat haltingly off a file cart in front of her.
"The Chinese are almost certainly sending Xi. He's also in his 60s. So if I thought they knew what they're doing, I'd be tempted to say, what the hell, let's send a 60-year-old man."
Drumlin, Terhier knew, was exactly 60 years old.
"On the other hand," he counterposed, I know,
The Indian doctor, she's in her 40s. In a way, this is the stupidest thing I ever heard of. We're picking somebody to enter the Olympics, and we don't know what the events are. I don't know why we're talking about sending scientists. Mahatma Gandhi, that's who we should send. Or while we're at it, Jesus Christ. Oh, don't tell me they're not available to hear, I know that. When you don't know what the events are, you send a decathlon champion. And then you discover the event is chess, or oratory, or sculpture, and your athlete finishes last. Okay, you say that it ought to be someone who's thought about extraterrestrial life, and who's been intimately involved with the receipt and decrypting of the message. Well, at least a person like that will be intimately involved with how the Vegans think, or at least how they expect us to think. And for really top-rate people, you say that reduces the field to 3? Again, she consulted her notes. Arroway, Drumlin, and the one who thinks he's a Roman general. Dr. Valerian, Miss President. I don't know that he thinks he's a Roman general, it's just his name. Valerian wouldn't even answer the selection committee's questionnaire. He wouldn't consider it because he won't leave his wife, is that right? Well, I'm not criticizing him, he's no dope. He knows how to make a relationship work. It's not that his wife is sick or anything. No, as far as I know, she's in excellent health. Good. Good for them. Send her a personal note from me. Something about how she must be some woman for an astronomer to give up the universe for her. But fancy up the language to hear. You know what I want. Oh, and throw in some quotation, poetry maybe, but not too gushy. She waved her index finger at him. Those Valerians can teach us all something. Why don't we invite them to a state dinner? The King of DePaul's here in 2 weeks. That'll be about right. Derheer was scribbling furiously. He would have to call the White House appointments secretary at home as soon as this meeting was over. And he had a still more urgent call. He had not been able to get to the telephone for hours. So that leaves Arroway and Drumlin. She's something like 20 years younger, but he's in terrific physical shape. He hang glides, skydives, scuba dives. He's a brilliant scientist. He helped in a big way to crack the message, and he'll have a fine time arguing with all the other old men. He didn't work on nuclear weapons, did he? I don't want to send anybody who worked on nuclear weapons. Now, Arroway's also a brilliant scientist. She's led this whole Argus project. She knows all the ins and outs of the message, and she has an inquiring mind. Everybody says that her interests are very broad. And she'd convey a younger American image. She paused. And you like her, Ken. Nothing wrong with that. I like her, too. But sometimes she's a loose cannon. Did you listen carefully to her questionnaire? I think I know the passage you're talking about, Miss President. But the selection committee had been asking her questions for almost 8 hours, and sometimes she gets annoyed at what she considers dumb questions. Drumlin's the same way. Maybe she learned it from him. She was his student for a while, you know. Yeah, he said some dumb things, too. Here, it's supposed to be all queued up for us on this VCR. First Arroway's questionnaire, then Drumlin's. Just press the play button, Ken. On the television screen, Ellie was being interviewed in her office at the Argus Project. He could even make out the yellowing piece of paper with the quote from Kafka. Perhaps, all things considered, Ellie would have been happier had she received only silence from the stars. There were lines around her mouth and bags under her eyes. There were also 2 unfamiliar vertical creases on her forehead just above her nose. Ellie on videotape looked terribly tired, and Drahir felt a pang of guilt. "What do I think of the world population crisis?" Ellie was saying. "You mean, am I for it or against it?" "You think this is a key question I'm going to be asked on Vega? And you want to make sure I give the right answer?" "Okay. Overpopulation is why I'm in favor of homosexuality and a celibate clergy. A celibate clergy is an especially good idea because it tends to suppress any hereditary propensity toward fanaticism." Ellie waited, deadpan, indeed frozen for the next question. The president had pushed the pause button. "Now, I admit that some of the questions may not have been the best," the president continued. But we didn't want anybody in such a prominent position on a project with really positive international implications who turns out to be some racist bozo. We want the developing world on our side in this one. We had a good reason to ask a question like that. Don't you find her answers show some lack of tact? She's a bit of a wise ass, your Dr. Arroway. Now, take a look at Drumlin. Wearing a blue polka dot bow tie, Drumlin was looking tanned and very fit.
"Yes, I know we all have emotions," he was saying. "But let's bear in mind exactly what emotions are. They're motivations for adaptive behavior from a time when we were too stupid to figure things out. But I can figure out that if a pack of hyenas are headed toward me with their fangs bared, there's trouble ahead. I don't need a few cc's of adrenaline to help me understand the situation. I can even figure out that it might be important for me to make some genetic contribution to the next generation. I don't really need testosterone in my bloodstream to help me along. Are you sure that an extraterrestrial being far in advance of us is going to be saddled with emotions? I know there are people who think I'm too cold, too reserved. But if you really want to understand the extraterrestrials, you'll send me. I'm more like them than anyone else you'll find."
"Some choice," the president said. "The one's an atheist and the other thinks he's from Vega already. Why do we have to send scientists? Why can't we send somebody normal?" "Just a rhetorical question," she quickly added. "I know why we have to send scientists. The message is about science, and it's written in scientific language. Science is what we know we share with the beings on Vega. No, those are good reasons, Ken. I remember them."
"She's not an atheist. She's an agnostic.
Her mind is open. She's not trapped by dogma. She's intelligent, she's tough, and she's very professional. The range of her knowledge is broad. She's just the person we need in this situation." "Ken, I'm pleased by your commitment to uphold the integrity of this project. But there's a great deal of fear out there. Don't think I don't know how much the men out there have had to swallow already. More than half the people I talk to believe we've got no business building this thing. If there's no turning back, they want to send somebody absolutely safe. Arroway may be all the things you say she is, but safe she isn't. I'm catching a lot of heat from the Hill, from the Earthfirsters, from my own national committee, from the churches. I guess she impressed Palmer Joss in that California meeting, but she managed to infuriate Billy Joe Rankin. He called me up yesterday and said, 'Ms. President.' He can't disguise his distaste at saying 'Ms.' 'Ms. President,' he says, 'that machine's gonna fly straight to God or the devil. Whichever one it is, you better send an honest-to-God Christian.' He tried to use his relationship with Palmer Joss to muscle me, for God's sake. I don't think there is any doubt he was angling to go himself. Drumlin's going to be much more acceptable to somebody like Rankin than Arroway is." I recognize Drumlin's something of a cold fish, but he's reliable, patriotic, sound. He has impeccable scientific credentials, and he wants to go. No, it has to be Drumlin. The best I can offer is to have her as backup."
"Can I tell her that?"
"We can't have Arroway knowing before Drumlin, can we? I'll let you know the moment a final decision is made, and we've informed Drumlin."
"Oh, cheer up, Ken.
Don't you want her to stay here on Earth?" It was after 6 when Ellie finished her briefing of the State Department's Tiger Team that was backstopping the American negotiators in Paris. Dahir had promised to call her as soon as the crew selection meeting was done. He wanted her to hear from him whether she had been selected, not from anybody else. She had been insufficiently deferential to the examiners she knew, and might lose out for that reason among a dozen others. Nevertheless, she guessed, there might still be a chance. There was a message waiting for her at the hotel. Not a pink "while you were out" form filled in by the hotel operator, but a sealed, unstamped, hand-delivered letter. It read, "Meet me at the National Science and Technology Museum, 8 p.m. tonight, Palmer Joss." No hello, no explanations, no agenda, and no "yours truly," she thought. This really is a man of faith. The stationery was her hotel's, and there was no return address. He must have sauntered in this afternoon, knowing from the Secretary of State himself, for all she knew, that Ellie was in town,
and expecting her to be in. It had been a tiresome day, and she was annoyed at having to spend any time away from piecing together the message. Although a part of her was reluctant to go, she showered, changed, bought a bag of cashews, and was in a taxi in 45 minutes. It was about an hour before closing, and the museum was almost empty. Huge, dark machinery was stuffed into every corner of a vast entrance hall. Here was the pride of the 19th-century shoemaking, textile, and coal industries. A steam calliope from the 1876 exposition was playing a jaunty piece, originally written for brass, she judged, for a tourist group from West Africa. Joss was nowhere to be seen. She suppressed the impulse to turn on her heel and leave. If you had to meet Palmer Joss in this museum, she thought, and the only thing you had ever talked to him about was religion and the message, where would you meet him? It was a little like the frequency selection problem in SETI. You haven't yet received a message from an advanced civilization, and you have to decide on which frequencies these beings, about whom you know virtually nothing, not even their existence, have decided to transmit. It must involve some knowledge that both you and they share. You and they certainly both know what the most abundant kind of atom in the universe is, and the single radio frequency at which it characteristically absorbs and emits. That was the logic by which the 1420 megahertz line of neutral atomic hydrogen had been included in all the early SETI searches. What would the equivalent be here? Alexander Graham Bell's telephone? The telegraph? Marconi's? Of course. Does this museum have a Foucault pendulum? She asked the guard. The sound of her heels echoed on the marble floors as she approached the rotunda. Joss was leaning over the railing, peering at a mosaic tile representation of the cardinal directions. There were small vertical hour marks, some upright, others evidently knocked down by the bob earlier in the day. Around 7 p.m., someone had stopped its swing and it now hung motionless. They were entirely alone. He had heard her approach for a minute at least and had said nothing. "You've decided that prayer can stop a pendulum?" she smiled.
"That would be an abuse of faith," he replied.
"I don't see why. You'd make an awful lot of converts. It's easy enough for God to do, and if I remember correctly, you talk to him regularly." "That's not it, huh? You really want to test my faith in the physics of harmonic oscillators? Okay." A part of her was amazed that Joss would put her through this test, but she was determined to pass muster. She let her handbag slide off her shoulder and removed her shoes. He gracefully hurdled the brass guardrail and helped her over. They half walked and half slid down the tiled slope until they were standing alongside the bob. It had a dull black finish, and she wondered whether it was made of steel or lead. "You'll have to give me a hand," she said. She could easily put her arms around the bob. And together they wrestled it until it was inclined at a good angle from the vertical and flush against her face. Joss was watching her closely. He didn't ask her whether she was sure. He neglected to warn her about falling forward. He offered no cautions about giving the bob a horizontal component of velocity as she let go. Behind her was a good meter or meter and a half of level floor before it started sloping upward to become a circumferential wall. If she kept her wits about her, she said to herself, this was a lead pipe cinch. She let go. The bob fell away from her. The period of a simple pendulum, she thought, a little giddily, is 2 pi, square root L over G, where L is the length of the pendulum, and G is the acceleration due to gravity. Because of friction in the bearing, the pendulum can never swing back farther than its original position. All I have to do is not sway forward, she reminded herself. Near the opposite railing, the bob slowed and came to a dead stop. Reversing its trajectory, it was suddenly moving much faster than she had expected. As it careened toward her, it seemed to grow alarmingly in size. It was enormous and almost upon her. She gasped. I flinched, Ellie said in disappointment as the bob fell away from her.
Only the littlest bit.
No, I flinched.
You believe?
You believe in science. There's only a tiny smidgen of doubt.
No, that's not it. That was a million years of brains fighting a billion years of instinct. That's why your job is so much easier than mine.
In this matter, our jobs are the same.
My turn, he said, and jarringly grabbed the bob at the highest point in its trajectory. But we're not testing your belief in the conservation of energy. He smiled and tried to dig in his feet.
What are you doing down there? A voice asked. Are you folks crazy?
A museum guard, dutifully checking that all visitors would leave by closing time, had come upon this unlikely prospect of a man, a woman, a pit, and a pendulum in an otherwise deserted recess of the cavernous building.
Oh, it's all right, officer, Joss said cheerfully. We're just testing our faith.
You can't do that in the Smithsonian Institution, the guard replied. This is a museum.
Laughing, Joss and Ellie wrestled the bob to a nearly stationary position and clambered up the sloping tile walls.
It must be permitted by the First Amendment, she said.
Or the First Commandment, he replied.
She slipped on her shoes, shouldered her bag, and head held high, accompanied Joss and the guard out of the rotunda. Without identifying themselves, and without being recognized, they managed to talk him out of arresting them. But they were escorted out of the museum by a tight phalanx of uniformed personnel, who were concerned, perhaps, that Ellie and Joss might next sidle aboard the steam calliope in pursuit of an elusive god. The street was deserted. They walked wordlessly along the mall. The night was clear, and Ellie made out Lyra against the horizon.
The bright one over there, that's Vega, she said.
He stared at it for a long time. That decoding was a brilliant achievement, he said at last.
Oh, nonsense.
It was trivial. It was the easiest message an advanced civilization could think of. It would have been a genuine disgrace if we hadn't been able to figure it out.
You don't take compliments well, I've noticed.
No, this is one of those discoveries that change the future.
Our expectations of the future, anyway.
It's like fire, or
writing, or agriculture, or the Annunciation.
He stared again at Vega. If you could have a seat in that machine, if you could ride it back to its sender, what do you think you would see? Evolution is a stochastic process. There are just too many possibilities to make reasonable predictions about what life elsewhere might be like. If you had seen the Earth before the origin of life, would you have predicted a katydid or a giraffe?
Oh, I know the answer to that question. I guess you imagine that we just make this stuff up, that we read it in some book or pick it up in some prayer tent.
But that's not how it is. I have certain positive knowledge from my own direct experience. I can't put it any plainer than that. I have seen God face to face. About the depth of his commitment, there seemed no doubt. Tell me about it. So he did.
Okay, she said finally.
You were clinically dead. Then you revived, and you remember rising through the darkness into a bright light. You saw a radiance with a human form that you took to be God, but there was nothing in the experience that told you the radiance made the universe or laid down moral law. The experience is an experience. You were deeply moved by it, no question, but there are other possible explanations.
Such as?
Well, like birth.
Birth is rising through a long, dark tunnel into a brilliant light.
Don't forget how brilliant it is. The baby has spent 9 months in the dark. Birth is its first encounter with light. Think of how amazed and awed you'd be in your first contact with color or light and shade or the human face, which you're probably pre-programmed to recognize. Maybe if you almost die, the odometer gets set back to zero for a moment. Understand, I don't insist on this explanation. It's just one of many possibilities. I'm suggesting you may have misinterpreted the experience.
You haven't seen what I've seen.
He looked up once more at the cold, flickering, blue-white light from Vega, and then turned to her. Don't you ever feel lost in your universe? How do you know what to do? How to behave if there's no God? Just obey the law or get arrested? You're not worried about being lost, Palmer. You're worried about not being central, not the reason the universe was created. There's plenty of order in my universe. Gravitation, electromagnetism, quantum mechanics, super unification, they all involve laws. And as for behavior, why can't we figure out what's in our best interest as a species? That's a warm-hearted and noble view of the world, I'm sure, and I'd be the last to deny that there's goodness in the human heart. But how much cruelty has been done when there was no love of God? And how much cruelty when there was? Savonarola and Torquemada loved God, or so they said. Your religion assumes that people are children and need a boogeyman so they'll behave. You want people to believe in God so they'll obey the law. That's the only means that occurs to you. A strict, secular police force and the threat of punishment by an all-seeing God for whatever the police overlook. You sell human beings short. Palmer, you think if I haven't had your religious experience, I can't appreciate the magnificence of your God. But it's just the opposite. I listen to you and I think, his God is too small. One paltry planet a few thousand years? Hardly worth the attention of a minor deity, much less the creator of the universe. Oh, you're confusing me with some other preacher. That museum was Brother Rankin's territory. I'm prepared for a universe billions of years old. I just say the scientists haven't proved it. And I say you haven't understood the evidence. How can it benefit the people if the conventional wisdom, the religious truths, are a lie? When you really believe that people can be adults, you'll preach a different sermon. There was a brief silence, punctuated only by the echoes of their footfalls. I'm sorry if I've been a little too strident, she said. It happens to me from time to time. I give you my word, Dr. Arroway. I'll carefully ponder what you've said this evening. You've raised some questions I should have answers for. But in the same spirit, let me ask you a few questions. Okay? She nodded, and he continued. Think of what consciousness feels like, what it feels like this minute. Does that feel like billions of tiny atoms wiggling in place? And beyond the biological machinery, where in science can a child learn what love is? Here's... Her beeper buzzed. It was probably Ken with the news she had been waiting for. If so, it had been a very long meeting for him. Maybe it was good news, nevertheless. She glanced at the letters and numbers forming in the liquid crystal. Ken's office number. There were no public telephones in sight, but after a few minutes they were able to flag down a taxicab. I'm sorry I have to leave so suddenly, she apologized. I enjoyed our conversation, and I'll think seriously about your questions. Oh, you wanted to pose one more? Yes. What is there in the precepts of science that keeps a scientist from doing evil? Chapter 15. Erbium Dowell. The Earth, that is sufficient. I do not want the constellations any nearer. I know they are very well where they are. I know they suffice for those who belong to them. Walt Whitman. Leaves of Grass. Song of the Open Road, 1855. It took years. It was a technological dream and a diplomatic nightmare. But finally they got around to building the machine. Various neologisms were proposed and project names evocative of ancient myths. But from the beginning, everyone had called it simply the machine, and that became its official designation. The continuing complex and delicate international negotiations were described by Western editorial writers as machine politics. When the first reliable estimate of the total cost was generated, even the titans of the aerospace industry gasped. Eventually it came to $500 billion a year for some years, roughly a third of the total military budget, nuclear and conventional, of the planet. There were fears that building the machine would ruin the world economy. "Economic warfare from Vega?" asked the London Economist. The daily headlines in the New York Times were, by any dispassionate measure, more bizarre than any in the now-defunct National Enquirer a decade earlier. The record will show that no psychic, seer, prophet, or soothsayer, no person with claimed precognitive abilities, no astrologer, no numerologist, and no late December copywriter on the year ahead had predicted the message or the machine, much less Vega, prime numbers, Adolf Hitler, the Olympics, and the rest. There were many claims, however, by those who had clearly foreseen the events, but had carelessly neglected to write the precognition down. Predictions of surprising events always prove more accurate, if not set down on paper beforehand. It is one of those odd regularities of everyday life. Many religions were in a slightly different category. A careful and imaginative perusal of their sacred writings will reveal, it was argued, a clear foretelling of these wondrous happenings. For others, the machine represented a potential bonanza for the world aerospace industry, which had been in worrisome decline since the Hiroshima Accords took full force. Very few new strategic weapons systems were under development. Habitats in space were a growing business, but they hardly compensated for the loss of orbiting laser battle stations and other accoutrements of the strategic defense envisioned by an earlier administration. Thus, some of those who worried about the safety of the planet if the machine were to be built swallowed their scruples when contemplating the implications for jobs, profits, and career advancement. A well-placed few argued that there was no richer prospect for the high-technology industries than a threat from space. There would have to be defenses, immensely powerful surveillance radars, eventual outposts on Pluto or in the Oort comet cloud. No amount of discourse about military disparities between terrestrials and extraterrestrials could daunt these visionaries. "Even if we can't defend ourselves against them," they asked, "don't you want us to see them coming?" There was profit here, and they could smell it. They were building the machine, of course, trillions of dollars worth of machine. But the machine was only the beginning, if they played their cards right. An unlikely political alliance coalesced behind the re-election of President Lasker, which became, in effect, a national referendum on whether to build the machine. Her opponent warned of Trojan horses and doomsday machines, and the prospect of demoralization of American ingenuity in the face of aliens who had already invented everything. The president pronounced herself confident that American technology would rise to the challenge, and implied, although she did not actually say, that American ingenuity would eventually equal anything they had on Vega. She was re-elected by a respectable, but by no means overwhelming, margin. The instructions themselves were a decisive factor. Both in the primer on language and basic technology, and in the message on the construction of the machine, nothing was left unclear. Sometimes intermediate steps that seemed entirely obvious were spelled out in tedious detail, as when, in the foundations of arithmetic, it is proved that if 2 times 3 equals 6, then 3 times 2 also equals 6. At every stage of construction there were checkpoints. The erbium produced by this process should be 96% pure, with no more than a fraction of a percent impurity from the other rare earths. When component 31 is completed and placed in a 6-molar solution of hydrofluoric acid, the remaining structural elements should look like the diagram in the accompanying figure. When component 408 is assembled, application of a 2 megagauss transverse magnetic field should spin the rotor up to so many revolutions per second before it returns itself to a motionless state. If any of the tests failed, you went back and redid the whole business. After a while, you got used to the tests, and you expected to be able to pass them. It was akin to rote memorization. Many of the underlying components, constructed by special factories designed from scratch by following the primer instructions, defied human understanding.
It was hard to see why they should work, but they did. Even in such cases, practical applications of the new technologies could be contemplated. Occasionally, promising insights seemed to be available for the skimming.
In metallurgy, for example.
Or in organic semiconductors. In some cases, several alternative technologies were supplied to produce an equivalent component. The extraterrestrials could not be sure, apparently, which approach would be easiest for the technology of the Earth. As the first factories were built and the first prototypes produced, pessimism diminished about human ability to reconstruct an alien technology from a message written in no known language. There was the heady feeling of arriving unprepared for a school test and finding that you can figure out the answers from your general education and your common sense. As in all competently designed examinations, taking it was a learning experience. All the first tests were passed. The erbium was of adequate purity. The pictured superstructure was left after the inorganic material was etched away by hydrofluoric acid. The rotor spun up as advertised. The message flattered the scientists and engineers, critics said. They were becoming caught up in the technology and losing sight of the dangers. For the construction of one component, a particularly intricate set of organic chemical reactions was specified, and the resulting product was introduced into a swimming pool-sized mixture of formaldehyde and aqueous ammonia. The mass grew, differentiated, specialized, and then just sat there, exquisitely more complex than anything like it humans knew how to build. It had an intricately branched network of fine hollow tubes, through which perhaps some fluid was to circulate.
It was colloidal,
pulpy, dark red. It did not make copies of itself, but it was sufficiently biological to scare a great many people. They repeated the procedure and produced something apparently identical. How the end product could be significantly more complicated than the instructions that went into building it was a mystery. The organic mass squatted on its platform and did, so far as anyone could tell, nothing. It was to go inside the dodecahedron, just above and below the crew area. End of side 12.